America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. So much going on today. The House Judiciary Committee has approved subpoenas for Karl Rove, Harriet Myers. Our conversation, you recall, I think it was last week at Greg Palast, about Harriet Myers' role back in Texas as the fixer to cover up George W. Bush's father's involvement in his getting into the Texas Air National Guard, and then Alberto Gonzalez's role in covering up George Bush's conviction for drunk driving, all of this, you know, the problems for him and the possible problems for him in the 2000 election, and maybe payback. Oh, anyhow, these folks are going to be called before Congress. The Bush administration says, no, we're not going to talk about it. We'll be talking about that as the morning goes on, or afternoon, or day, as wherever you may be, whatever time it may be. We'll be getting into these things. Also, Al Gore testifying before the United States Senate today, or the House and then the Senate, about global warming. And just an awful lot going on. And some weird stuff with regard to Russia and Iran. We'll get into that a little later on in the program as well. Right now, Dan Gaynor is with us. He's with the he is the director, actually, of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org. And, Dan, welcome to the program. Great to meet you at the CPAC conference.
Oh, it's a pleasure as well. It's kind of always weird when you're talking to someone 3,000 miles away and you finally get to meet them. Yeah. So it was a pleasure.
Yeah, he doesn't have fangs. Holy cow.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that was your reaction. I imagine mine.
All righty. Dan, you guys sent out a news release or an article. This is about the fact that several members of Congress, now that the Democrats have taken Congress, they're doing away with, or they're starting to do away with, this idea that Medicare, the government program, the government health care program, cannot, by law, negotiate with pharmaceutical companies. And I want to read three sentences from this thing and just let you respond to it, because it just boggles my mind that you guys are framing it this way. I don't get it. Here's what it says. It didn't take long for the new Congress to try to increase government regulation of health care through mandated prescription prices. Less than 1 month after taking power, House Democrats okayed a bill requiring federal drug price negotiation for 23 million people covered by Medicare's prescription drug plan. The House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform took the issue further and held hearings on allegations that the pharmaceutical industry was profiteering from public health programs at the expense of the American taxpayer and the most vulnerable in our society. Chairman Henry Waxman opened the hearing with a list of complaints about the drug business, among them that drug companies were reporting massive increases in their profits. What's wrong with the government negotiating with drug companies for pharmaceutical prices? Certainly the government does it in the case of the Veterans Administration, for example.
Well, when the people who are negotiating for prices are also the people who can lock you up or shut down your company, they kind of have a little, a little extra power over you. That's not a fair
negotiation. They're not. The Medicare does not have any regulatory power over the pharmaceutical industry. They only have negotiating
power. Congress does.
But Congress is not doing the negotiating.
But Congress is making it happen at the same time, on one hand, doing that. Did you by any chance see any of the hearing?
No, I didn't.
It was streamed on the internet. I got to watch a little of it. And some of the comments were just so over the top attacking the pharmaceutical industry. Now look, you want to go after somebody, then at least be fair about it. To say that, to paint the pharmaceutical industry as these horrible villains and forget that at the same time they're out there creating drugs that give us this incredible life expectancy, and basically everybody I know at this point in my life takes some regular medication to help deal with, my case it's the thyroid problem, many cases it's whether it's mental health issues or whatever. And so this massive attack, and it's really being pushed.
Well, everybody, Dan, come on, everybody uses electricity too. That doesn't mean that Ken Lay and Enron were saints.
I know, but it doesn't mean, but at the same time, it doesn't mean that the whole pharmaceutical industry is bad, which is certainly the way both the House Democrats and ultimately, in a big way, the media portray them.
Well, here's the problem I think a lot of people have. You had Billy Towson, the congressman from Louisiana, who was arguably the lead author of this sentence in the Medicare Act, which said that it was against the law against the law for government to negotiate prices with pharmaceutical manufacturers. In other words, they simply had to buy everything at full retail. They couldn't say, can you give us the wholesale price on that? We're buying 30 million pills this year. Billy Towson, and then he has to get a special exemption from Congress so that a month before his term is out, he can go to work for $2 million a year as a lobbyist for pharma, the front company for the big drug companies. I mean, most people look at that and they go, that stinks.
Hey, I'm not going to defend Billy Towson one way or the other. I mean, I personally, were it up to me, I would never give exemptions for stuff like that. You know,
okay, well, you think he should have waited another month before he started taking his $2 million a year salary.
I think the way it's supposed to work, my opinion, the way it should work is if you're a member of Congress, there should be some law, you should agree at least to some long time afterwards that you're not going to work for anybody.
Well, at long last, we should ring a bell. Dan and I have found something we agree on.
Oh, yeah,
what I don't understand is why Dan, we're talking about Dan Gaynor, he's the director of the Business and Media Institute, businessandmedia.org, why you guys are saying, you're characterizing the ability of government to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies as, quote, requiring federal drug price negotiation for 23 million people. I mean, as if that's a bad thing. I thought, frankly, that you were in favor of competition.
That's not competition. When you have one... Well,
you've got five different drug companies that make penicillin, for example. Now they're going to have to compete with each other to see who gets the government's business.
Well, first of all, not all drugs are alike. One of the problems when you get the government mandating things. In fact, I deal with this in my own life. The perception that generics are the same as the main drug, it's completely bogus. Because, if you go to a pharmacy, you take a name drug, and then they fill it with a generic. The variance between the generic and the name drug is huge. So,
the variance from batch to batch of the named drug can be huge too. I mean, that's a specious argument.
You can get here's the thing. So assume the name drug is let's say roughly around one. The variance is allowed 20% off of one for a generic. So the variance, and I've had this problem, variance can literally go from 80% to 120.
But I believe that if your batch-to-batch variant is the same. In other words, the name drug that they made last week can have as much of as a 20% variation this week. I mean, in other words, they're both held to the exact same standards.
But you could, when you go and get a generic filled, you can get one company that goes to the light and one company goes to heavy, so literally you can, and it's just the result of crazy government regulation. That's the point, rather than get lost in a sidetrack.
Reason why you think it's bad thing that the government is able to negotiate for drug prices.
The problem with government, the people who can lock you up, the people who can call members, CEOs, and Congress loves to do this, they call CEOs up on the carpet and say, basically, you either do what we want, or we're going to investigate you, or Hillary Clinton said we're going to take your profits. She said that about the oil companies. The problem with that...
She said they were going to take their windfall profits.
No, she didn't say that. That's not what she said. She said, I want to take those profits.
I think you'd have to acknowledge that she literally didn't mean we're going to take all your profits. You're going to take her at her word. All right.
That's the thing. I mean, I'm trying to take a politician at their word. I agree. No matter which side of the aisle we're talking about that, there's a talk about a variance. There's a lot of variance on that one.
Dan, the government, when it's buying jet fighters from Boeing, negotiates for prices. The government, when it's buying bullets from whoever they buy bullets from, negotiates for prices. I mean, it's a mandated process with everything the government buys. If not competitive bidding, at least a transparent process, except for pharmaceuticals. Why should there be that exception?
Because one of the problems, when the difference between a jet fighter and a consumer drug is huge. You're not getting, nobody's calling up their congressman and complaining, oh my God, I just got back from the jet fighter store and, the price went up $1.5 million. But they are
exactly. If you've got a whole bunch of elderly people living on the edge and they've got to pay more because the government can't negotiate prices, doesn't seem like a good thing.
But if the flip side is, then of course that leads to governments intimidating businesses based solely on the fact that politicians of both stripes, again, pander to voters.
So then we just shouldn't have Medicare at all, because if the government's doing it, it's going to do it wrong, right?
Oh, that's a discussion for another day. But yes, does government do a lot of things wrong? Yes, the answer is hugely yes.
Yeah, because that's I think ultimately what it's going to reduce down to is, you know, can government do things right or wrong? And interesting. Dan Gaynor, businessandmedia.org, the Business and Media Institute. Thanks for being with us, Dan.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
You've got a headache, and I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations, but it's worth it for the drugs I need.
Yes, indeed. Isn't the pharmaceutical industry extraordinary? 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in broadcasting for a change. By the way, if you live in Portland, Oregon, and you're listening on KPOJ or nearby, and you want to make it down to Portland Friday night at the Baghdad Theater, we're going to be screening Crude Impact with James Wood, the director. And just as a heads up, 22 minutes past the hour. An interesting article in today's, apropos of our conversation that we just had with Dan Gaynor, in today's New York Times. It starts out telling the story about Dr. Alan Collins, one of the most influential kidney specialists in the country, and all the money he was given by the pharmaceutical companies. Amgen, for example, paid him $25,800, just that one company. Turns out that the only way we know this is because Minnesota law requires the disclosure of this type of information. And the Minnesota records begin in 1997. This is when the law was first passed. This is from Gardner Harris and Janet Roberts' article. And from then through 2005, drug makers paid more than 5,500 doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers in that state, this is just Minnesota, at least $57 million. Another $40 million, now this is just in Minnesota, just money from the drug companies. Another $40 million went to clinics, research centers, and other organizations. More than 20% of the state's licensed docs, physicians, received money. More than 100 people received more than $100,000. I've written 7, I think, books on attention deficit disorder and learning disabilities and related issues out of the 19 books that I have in print right now. And there was a period of time, probably about 7-8 year period there, where I was doing a lot of speaking on the topic, speaking at conferences, doing in-service training in schools and things like that. And many of the people that I would like do the circuit with, and we did this in the United States, we did it throughout Europe, a lot in England and Germany in particular, and in Australia. And I, you know, I would travel with and got to know a lot of these people quite well, people who were psychiatrists, professors of psychiatry, MDs, psychologists. They would get these payments. And in fact, on one occasion, actually, I was offered one, and I don't have those, you know, highfalutin credentials. I mean, I'm presenting myself basically as an author. And you know, typically it was anywhere from $5,000 to $20,000 per speech. If you'll just, you know, speak well. There wasn't even an if there. I mean, you know that the money is coming from the manufacturer of a particular drug. And so, gee, you might just want to be sure to work that drug's name into your speech. Now, I never took any of that money. And I'm not, you know, holding myself up as a paragon of virtue. Very, very little of it was offered to me also. Although, frankly, I would have had a hard time taking it and promoting these things. But it's just, I'm telling you, from firsthand experience, this is just really common in the pharmaceutical industry. And it's you know, at what point do we say, okay, it is time to start having some transparency in this process? It's time for us to realize that the pharmaceutical manufacturers' marketing budgets are so huge. I mean, should they be advertising prescription drugs on TV? Should they be buying legislators so that those legislators can pass laws that make it illegal for the government to say, as they do with the Veterans Administration, to make it illegal for Medicare to do what the VA has been doing for, you know, presumably 50, 60 years, however long the Veterans Administration has been in existence, to say to drug manufacturers, okay, so the retail price is a dollar a pill on that penicillin. We're not gonna buy 10 pills like somebody coming into the pharmacy. We're gonna buy, you know, 8 million this year. What's your price? What's your wholesale price? And they say, well, okay, the wholesale price is 16 cents a pill. Great. We'll buy it for that. Or, you know, we can buy it from company A for 16 cents a pill. What's your price? Oh, my price is 15 cents a pill. You go back to company A. Company B will sell it for 15 cents a pill. Company A either says, we'll match that, or, hey, our price is 16, or, okay, we'll go to 14. And who wins? We do. We the people. Who loses? Well, arguably, you could say the drug manufacturers do, but the fact of the matter is that they're not going to sell products below cost. You know, Boeing isn't selling their aircraft to the government below cost. There's competitive bidding price, you know, processes. The companies that are selling, you know, air conditioning units to build for buildings, every other part. I mean, all the things from the toilet seats and airplane. Remember the $800 toilet seats? I mean, that's just this whole spectrum of stuff. I mean, now virtually all of it, except for that has to do with, you know, Iraq or Halliburton, which is moving to Dubai. Maybe there's some relationship here. Who knows? Except for that stuff that has to do with Bush's cronies, everything is competitively bid. And, you know, what's wrong with pharmaceuticals being part of that? It just seems like it should be. Just seems like it should be. By the way, Tony Snow, in 1998, wrote an absolutely brilliant op-ed in which he talked about how, and I kid you not, how most of us want, I'm quoting from his op-ed, most of us want no part of a president who is cynical enough to use the majesty of his office to evade the one thing he has sworn to uphold, the rule of law. Tony Snow going after executive privilege, as now he's going to promote executive privilege. Interesting. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Don't think of buying from Canada. Oh, we will not play nice. We wrote the new legislation forcing the nation to pay the top price. Oh, Grandma, sign the paper. Grandpa, don't be slow. Yes, you get medication. If you join our HMO, there's no more Medicare. Oh, you'll just have to trust us while we're making Medicare go.
Yeah, and see, I think that's the bottom line. 34 minutes past the hour, by the way, welcome back, is that the reason why conservatives want this legislation to stand that says that the pharmaceutical industry and Medicare cannot negotiate, that Medicare can't negotiate prices of drugs down, is because it's a poison pill. It was put in there to destroy Medicare. The bottom line is, let's just do away with Medicare. And one way to do it is to bankrupt it. And if you can bankrupt it, and in the meantime, you're big campaign contributors make millions or billions of dollars, all the better. Anyhow, enough on that. We'll take a few calls on it as well, but I think the point is made. Today, the House Judiciary Subcommittee on Commercial and Administrative Law voted in a voice vote. We don't know exactly who voted how. Apparently, some Republicans said yes, although it wouldn't have been absolutely necessary, voted to approve the authorization of subpoenas by the entire House Judiciary Committee. Now, Linda Sanchez, the Democrat, the chairwoman from California, is the chairwoman of the subcommittee. God bless her. She said there must be accountability. So now it goes to John Conyers. John Conyers, the guy who was a member of Congress and I believe a member of the Judiciary Committee. He's been on this program many times over the years. We've talked about it a few times, and my recollection pretty clear, during the impeachment of Nixon. So he has to decide if he's going to choose to issue the subpoenas. And if he does so, then it gets really interesting. Then it gets, in fact, you know, very interesting. Because once that happens, then you have the issue of, okay, what happens next? Okay, so the administration says, we're not going to go there. We're not going to show up. We're not going to have anything to do with your subpoena. We're not going to show up. So then Congress has to vote to hold them in contempt of Congress. That's a simple majority vote. So presumably they can do that in both the House and Senate. All it would take is maybe one or two Republicans in the Senate, depending on how Lieberman votes. And because, you know, Tim Johnson's not there. But it's a simple majority vote in the House and the Senate to hold these guys in contempt. And then it goes to the U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C. to decide what's going to be done about it. Whether or not he's going to impanel a grand jury, and if so, if he's going to try and prosecute them. And if he impanels a grand jury and if he charges them, then they get to appeal to the district court in Washington, D.C. And if the court rules against them, then they get to appeal to the Supreme Court. But that federal attorney, that U.S. attorney, is the guy who stands between the constitutional crisis, the going to the Supreme Court, and Congress. And that guy, by the way, is Jeff Taylor. He is... Back in March of last year, this little thing got slipped into the Patriot Act that said that Gonzalez can simply put somebody into office as a federal prosecutor without the Senate confirming them. And then that was in March. And then in September 22nd, the guy who was the federal prosecutor got promoted out of the job by Gonzalez. And Gonzalez puts in Jeff Taylor. Jeff Taylor is the guy who used to work for Gonzalez. And he also used to work for Orrin Hatch. In fact, he was one of the folks who helped write the Patriot Act. So the guy who used to work for Orrin Hatch, who helped write the Patriot Act, graduate of Brigham Young University, et cetera, you know, what's going back to Orrin Hatch's old stomping grounds, that guy, and also who worked for Alberto Gonzalez, good solid Republican credentials, that guy is the one who gets to decide whether or not there will be prosecution of these folks if the House and Senate decide to try and prosecute, you know, bring charges of contempt of Congress against them. It gets very, very weird, does it not? So, anyway, Everett and driving in Virginia. Hey, Everett, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Hey, man, I love your show, and I just wish Sirius would carry you the whole show. It's upsetting to me.
Well, thank you, Everett. They do just during different times. But anyhow, your question.
Hey, my question is this, Tom. I don't understand this. I'm seeing all these commercials on TV today from the AARP supporting what the...
Nope, we just lost you. In any case, if your question is why did the AARP support this legislation in the first place, or why might they be supporting the idea of not negotiating drug prices, it's because the AARP's primary source of income is not your membership check. It's the sale of insurance policies. And the insurance industry is making out like a bandit right now, selling all these secondary policies to insure against the donut hole. But that has to do with the donut hole, not so much the negotiations. Julian, Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening to WTKG. Hey, Julian, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am living with a man who is taking 12 different kinds of medication. He's on Medicare Plan D.
Mm-hmm.
And every single one of his medications, I noticed the price when they get it from the pharmacy, the shelf price, and then there is a your insurance saved you this amount, but some of it is by writing off a portion. Some of it is money that the insurance company actually paid.
Right.
So they are already cutting into the price on medication.
Well, they are, but the insurance company is doing that because you paid them in the first place. I mean, this is how insurance companies make their profit, is they get enough people paying in to buy insurance that there's more money being paid in for insurance than what they have to pay out for the drugs. So that's completely separate from whether, you know, what the price of the drugs may be. And they're also only covering that part, you know, that donut hole part. I mean, you've got Medicare covering
it. He doesn't have a donut hole.
Well, is he on Medicare?
Medicare, Medicaid.
Yeah, well, then Medicare pays. This is the whole point of Part D, is that Medicare pays for your drugs up until, what, $2,300 or something like that?
No, and they then pay the whole amount.
Pardon?
They pay the whole amount.
Right, and then once you've hit a certain number of dollars, several thousand dollars, then they pay nothing, and you have to have an insurance company to fill that hole. And then once you go above, I think it's 5,000 and change, then they start paying again. That's the famous donut hole, and that's really a separate thing from whether Medicare should be able to negotiate prescription drugs.
But if these companies are already negotiating prices for people who are on both Medicare and Medicaid and do not have a donut hole.
Right.
Why
can't the government? I mean, that would be my question.
Why can't they just do it for everybody?
Right. Well, that's the point. The drug companies want it. Right. The drug companies want it. And good point, Julian. The drug companies want it that no matter what a health insurance company may negotiate with them, Medicare can't negotiate with them. They have to pay the full price, period. Mary in Illinois. Hey, Mary, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hey, Mary, you're live and on the air. What's
up? Oh, okay. Yeah, I had a comment. I was listening to the lady before me. I used to work. I'm retired now for a company, a large telecommunications company, and you sure do negotiate with the federal government. They have a rule, or at least they did when I was working 5 years ago, that you could not sell a piece of equipment to any other company lower than you sold it to the U.S. government. And if they found out that you did, they could come in and audit all your books and get a refund from you for what
right.
they overpaid. So if
right.
you sold them one telephone system in the state of Illinois, for instance, but you had a customer that bought 500, so you negotiated a real good discount with them,
mm-hmm.
and you didn't give the federal government that same discount that you gave to this big customer, then
right.
you were in violation of the law. So they do
negotiate.
Oh,
that's interesting. Yeah, they and ferociously, apparently. Mary, thanks for the heads up on that. I appreciate it. John in Glendora, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? Regarding this thing where Bush is threatening to block this subpoenas, and there's a lot of people on the news saying that this could go to the Supreme Court. My question is, if this does go to the Supreme Court, being that he has most of his appointees on there, let's say they rule that he's within his rights, I mean, they're starting to overturn the way it looks and what you were talking about yesterday, that they're going to start overturning a lot of precedents that have been set for hundreds, if not, hundreds of years.
Right. Nixon, U.S. versus Nixon being the big one. Although in U.S. versus Nixon, and this is the point that Bush's apologists are making, in U.S. versus Nixon, the subpoena was in a criminal proceeding. In other words, there was already some of Nixon's aides had already been indicted criminally. And so they were saying that they wanted access to the White House tapes in order to prosecute those guys. And Nixon was saying, no, you can't have access to them. And that was the gist of that case in which the Supreme Court ruled against Richard Nixon. And they said, in the Supreme Court ruling in U.S. versus Nixon, they said, absent a claim of need to protect military, diplomatic, or sensitive national security secrets, we find it difficult to accept the argument that even the very important interest in confidentiality of presidential communications is significantly diminished by production of such material for in-camera inspection, with all the protection that a district court will be obliged to provide. This was a criminal proceeding, but still, there are some folks who are saying, wait a minute, if the executive branch, if the legislative branch can investigate the executive branch, that's going to lead to a situation where the executive branch can investigate the legislative branch. And I would say, well, you already have that. That's what happened to Duke Cunningham. The Justice Department, which is the executive branch, just went after the legislative branch and put one of their members in jail. So, executive privilege, the separation of powers, not when it comes to things that are violations of the law. And I think that that's where this is going to have to go before it goes to the Supreme Court, if the Democrats are going to play it right, and that is get some significant evidence of wrongdoing and indict 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Thank you.
back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Sleeping Giant in our chat room. You can get to our chat room, by the way, by going over to TomHartman.com and click live chat up at the top of the page. Sleeping Giant says, Tom, I am a diabetic living in Canada. My meds cost a total of $300 Canadian dollars per month. That would be, what, around 170 U.S.? I'm not sure what the Canadian dollar is these days. I checked the prices for the same meds in the U.S., and they total $500 U.S. Whatever happened to the law of supply and demand? Should not the meds be cheaper in the U.S.? Yeah, they should be. We have a larger pool of buyers. You would think that the prices would be lower. But you got some folks making a whole pile of money on this. Armin in Sarasota, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Armin.
The predatory Nazis and criminals, Nazis, that's a good one. That's PNAC group.
Mm-hmm.
You just made a point I was going to make. Why do they feel, the corporate Bushes, that another country has more rights, that has a socialized system that they sustain through discounts on drugs and pharmaceuticals? Why do they feel that another country, like Canada, with a socialized system, has more rights to sustainable, affordable health care than the citizens of the country that...
Well, because Canada's asserting the right. You know, it's not doing it at the expense of the drug companies. The drug companies are making money on the drugs they're selling in Canada. They're just not making as much money as they're making off you and me here. I mean,
I understand that, but effectively, they're giving another country more rights and privileges than the citizens that they're dependent upon in their host country.
Yeah, see, your statement assumes that the drug companies are dispensing rights, and I would disagree with that. But I think that your point is well made. The people in other countries have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. If you define the right of life as having to do with health care, they certainly enjoy that more than we do here. Jeff in Colorado on the line. Hey, Jeff, listening to AM 760. What's up, Jeff?
Tom, thanks. Hey, under your plan, a regular guy like me is going to be competing with the government now. I just go in and buy my drugs at the pharmacy, the day I can go in there and say, hey, I want to buy 50,000 Vicodin, I'll agree with you, but I can't.
Don't you think, though, Jeff, that when the government starts buying in bulk and those prices are known to pretty much everybody on Earth, that the pharmaceutical companies will not be able to maintain super, super high prices for everybody else who goes in and buys them?
Well, maybe. I guess. I don't know.
You know, I mean, it's just, you know, the word will get out. Hey, you know, your whatever your pharmaceutical is, you know, your drug of choice is a word. This is what everybody on Medicare is paying. How come I'm paying so much? I think at a certain point, people are gonna start saying that. And yeah, if you're buying pharmaceuticals with cash, you're very much in the minority in the United States. And occasionally you have situations where people who are very much in the minority, at least in an economic minority, it doesn't work out the best for them, although it's working out the best for everybody else. And I realize there's folks saying, oh, wait a minute, what is that, socialism or something? No, not really. But Matt in Carson, Washington. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's
well, on your mind? I'm adding on to meet the faxers, misdemeanors and high crimes. I'm
yes.
Faxing this to all my senators, and every senator I can get a fax number for.
Mm-hmm.
It's to cover up the latest in his litanies of lies. The self-described accountability president claims he deserves executive privilege because that's what he was born with. Bush serves at the pleasure of we, the people, that elected Congress to be our voice.
Demand
that Congress uphold its oath to protect and defend our Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic.
And therefore, you guys have to do it. Yeah, Matt, I'm sorry. We just don't do reading on the air. But, you know, yes, I agree with you. And if you look at White House, U.S. versus Nixon, you will see that it was a criminal case that prompted that thing making itself all the way up to the Supreme Court. Although there is plenty of precedent for presidents allowing their aides to testify under oath before Congress. Bill Clinton did a number of times, for example. There's plenty of precedent for it. But if this president decides to fight it, then Congress will be in a much stronger position if they have some evidence of a crime. And that, frankly, that's what I think they should be pursuing. They should be pointing out that, for example, Bush broke the law when he violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He has admitted that he broke the law. So let's go after law-breaking. Now, let's specifically look at criminal acts as opposed to what might be improprieties. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. You know, sometimes I teach introduction to psychology. We teach critical thinking, and the guest you had on made two violations of it. But the example I always use with the classes, they'll say Tylenol, number one hospital and doctor-recommended brand. It may be true that hospitals use that more than other brands, but that's because they get it donated to them for free, not because of any inherent better quality of the product.
Right.
So he said, firstly, that it's no good for Congress to negotiate with them because Congress has the power to call them up or shut down a business. The other side of it, he doesn't say, is that Congress has the power to license corporations and they can charge any super high price they want. And the consumer.
Right, they're doing business by virtue of the fact that government exists.
And the second one, which I thought was even more obvious, I know you have only a limited time to challenge him. He's saying that the politicians pander to the voters and that's why this change is coming through. What's more likely, Congress pandering to voters or Congress members pandering to rich donations from lobbyists, from big corporations that dance to their tune?
Right, and then there's the next step in that, Charlie, following the logic train there, and that is that Congress pandering to the voters is what we elect them to do. They're supposed to do what we want, right?
I mean,
that's the core... Yeah, thanks, Charlie. That's the core concept of democracy, is you're supposed to pattern us. We're the people. We put you there. You're supposed to represent us. We don't have leaders in America. We have representatives. Read the Constitution. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll continue the conversation. I got to share this great quote from Tony Snow with you right after the break. But stick around.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
And welcome back. Al Gore, speaking before the House Energy and Commerce Committee today. In response to a question from Congressman Joe Barton, the Republican from Texas, who's trying to cast doubt on this. You'll recall the entire first hour of our program yesterday, or the majority of it, was a conversation about specifically global warming with Ross Gelbspan, about, you know, what are the claims that the deniers are putting forward, the climate change deniers, and how can you knock down those claims? And we went through all of their various arguments and, you know, demonstrated that they're all wrong. So anyhow, Joe Barton says to Al Gore, he says, even the mainstream media are now noticing that global warming science is uneven and evolving. Sort of. I mean, in as much as the sort of noticing. And why would that be? Well, speaking as a talk show host, yesterday I got an email, which I'm sure every other talk show host in the country got, saying, Al Gore is going to be testifying before Congress tomorrow. Here are a list of climate skeptics that you would, you know, who are available to come onto your program. And, you know, many of the usual suspects, a number of them have actually been on this program in the past, to rebut Mr. Gore's testimony. So Al Gore's response, he says, 20 of the 21 hottest years ever measured in the human record have been in the last 25 years. I mean, this is just, you know, pretty unambiguous. The 10 hottest have been since 1980. This is the point that was made yesterday, I think, so clearly, and that is that it's not, oh, yeah, it's been warmer than this before, but it's never gotten this warm this fast. It's about the rate of change. Other than when we've been hit by asteroids or something like that. I mean, that's certainly rather radical and sudden challenge. But we're at the edge of that. I mean, this is a book that Richard Leakey wrote, what, 10 years ago, called The Fifth Extinction, in which he laid out how species are going extinct right now at a rate that is roughly equal to or close to that of when the dinosaurs vanished. And, you know, guess what? When you have a mass extinction event, the animals at the top of the food chain are the ones who go. And who's at the top of the food chain right now? Us! So Gore says, the planet has a fever. If your baby has a fever, you go to the doctor. If the doctor says you need to intervene here, you don't say, well, I read a science fiction novel that tells me it's not a problem. If the crib's on fire, you don't speculate that the baby is flame retardant. You take action. This planet has a fever. Well said, President Gore. Also, Bob Barr going after this, the, by the way, this is from the Think Progress blog, thinkprogress.org, the Center for American Progress. Bob Barr going after the White House. Yesterday, I shared with you these four conservatives who have come out and basically said the Bush administration is ripping apart America. Now, these are my words, not theirs, but the Bush administration has, they're actually proposing legislation that would essentially put us back together, that would give us back habeas corpus rights, that is the right to be faced with your accusers, the right to have your day in court. But literally, it's you know, at the core of habeas corpus is simply the right to have your day in court. But then the extension of that, the things that you find, for example, in the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth amendments to the Constitution. The right to be confronted by your accusers, the right to a trial by a jury of your peers, the right to make bail, the right to not be subject to cruel and unusual punishment. And Bob Barr among those, along with Richard Viguerie, oddly enough, these four conservatives who are coming out and saying, no, wait a minute, what Bush is doing is not conservative. It's not liberal either, by the way. It is anti-American. And they're not putting up with it. And Bob Barr now, the guy who was the House leader, House floor leader, one of the House floor leaders for the impeachment of Bill Clinton. He came out and said, the integrity of the Department of Justice is being used as a political football by the administration to prove who's the toughest hombre in this. The administration really ought to be going out of its way to do what prior administrations have done, such as the Bush 1 administration and Reagan administrations, and that is take whatever steps are necessary to assure the American people that the integrity of our justice system has not been compromised. Let me just lay it right out. He also said members of Congress, quote, have a pretty clear right to demand information related to the U.S. attorney purge. He says, after all, these are the people, whether Karl Rove or U.S. attorney or attorney general, who are paid for by the taxpayers with funds appropriated by the Congress, and Congress has a right to assure itself that these funds are being used properly. Which brings us back, I mean, to this whole, Bush says, well, you know, I've got to be able to get private advice. Yeah, I've got to make sure that somebody walks into my office and says something that they know that they have some level of confidentiality. Well, yeah, it makes certain sense, as long as you're not conspiring to commit crimes. And in particular, that makes sense if the conversation that you're having has to do with military, diplomatic, or sensitive national security secrets, to quote the Supreme Court. But otherwise, simply saying, because I'm president, nobody has any right to know, I don't think it's going to fly. On the other hand, and this is where the concerned skeptic in me comes out, you will recall Dick Cheney tried asserting largely the same thing, saying that he didn't have to tell us who were the members of his energy task force, because as vice president, as a member of the executive branch, he wouldn't be able to get good advice from people if we had to know who they were who were advising him. Which is even a weirder argument than saying what they said. And that went to the Supreme Court, and Cheney won, as I recall. Correct me if I'm wrong on this, but that's my recollection that, actually the Supreme Court ruled, I'll have to go back and track that down, because now I'm remembering that the Supreme Court ruled that at some point in the future he would have to reveal that, but it did not have to be before the election. there was a time thing in that. So anyhow, we'll see how this comes out. This is from the United States versus Nixon. This is the Supreme Court decision that is like the mother of all of them. It's, you know, in the modern era, in the last 50 years. And this is where Richard Nixon was saying that his tapes, the tapes in his office, did not have to be turned over to a court because he had executive privilege. And quoting from the Supreme Court ruling, the president's need for complete candor and objectivity from advisors calls for great deference from the courts. Okay, so they start out acknowledging, yeah, you're right. However, when the privilege depends solely on the broad, undifferentiated claim of public interest in the confidentiality of such conversations, which is essentially what Bush said yesterday, a confrontation with other values arises. This is the Supreme Court in U.S. versus Nixon. Absent a claim of need to protect military, diplomatic, or sensitive national security secrets, we, the Supreme Court, find it difficult to accept the argument that even the very important interest of confidentiality of presidential communications is significantly diminished by production of such material for an in-camera inspection with all the protection that a district court will be obliged to provide. Now, what they were saying was in a criminal case where the court can provide some protection to the information, it's not just going to all be laid out there, that, sorry, Charlie, or sorry, Richard, in this case, you're going to have to reveal this information. Now, to extend this to the Congress, to extend this to a situation where there hasn't been an actual indictment for a criminal case, that's going to be a lot harder to do, frankly. And that's why, in my opinion, Congress should be taking the tact that they are looking into actual high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, just, you know, turn this into an impeachment investigation for that matter. Then the rules of the game change. But here, this is a famous quote from Tony Snow. Taken to its logical extreme, that position, that's the position of executive privilege, would make it impossible for citizens to hold a chief executive accountable for anything. He would have a constitutional right to cover up. Most of us want no part of a president who's cynical enough to use the majesty of his office to evade the one thing he's sworn to uphold, the rule of law. Well, that was Tony Snow back when Bill Clinton was saying that he shouldn't have to produce information in the Monica Lewinsky investigation. Information that ultimately was presented. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Get up every morning and ignore the global warming. Head out to the Oval Office, start my day. I keep my donors all protected so I can be re-elected. Give them access just as long as they pay. And to the four good crooks who keep cooking up the books, we make sure we look the other way. The laws are theirs to break, long as I still get my take. My war chest keeps on growing each day. And I've been taking care of business every day.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. Welcome back to the radio support group of by and for we the people of the United States of America, of North America, the planet Earth, of all living things. Here we are. I mean, we are all in this together. We really are. What a radical liberal idea. Looking at the Supreme Court case that had to do with Dick Cheney and his energy task force. I've been looking over this thing during the break, and it was a 7-2 decision, and Ginsburg and Souter were the dissenters. And although there was sort of a secondary dissent, even though they agreed, even though they voted to send it back to the lower court, which basically bought Cheney more time, Clarence Thomas and Scalia were concerned that the district court had, quote, clearly exceeded its authority in this case, ordering a wide-ranging search of executive branch documents. But you know, looking this thing over, I don't think that this is going to be any kind of precedent on this, although what it does do is it indicates that there's a bias may be the wrong word, but let's say there are a number of members of the court who are quite fond of Mr. Cheney. And they certainly helped him out in this case because this was before the 2004 election. And the Sierra Club, just to give you the story again, the Sierra Club and Judicial Watch had sued Cheney saying that they wanted access to documents. You know, who showed up for his Energy Task Force? This is the Energy Task Force that met in April. And some of those documents came out. Judicial Watch, you can see them over at their website. This is Larry Klayman's organization. The guy who did the investigations that and FOIA requests that ultimately led to, and prosecution arguably, that led to the whole Monica Lewinsky thing, conservative Larry Klayman, his organization suing Dick Cheney saying that they wanted the information. And the court said, no, you send it back down to the court. You don't have to pass out that information, who was in the Energy Task Force before the election. Now, there's two differences here. One, this is not Congress, although on the other side, this is the executive branch asserting some sort of privilege. But it's not Congress, so it's not a really clean case. And secondly, the decision was simply to send the thing back down to the circuit court, or to the district court, rather. So I think probably the closer one is the U.S. versus Nixon. That's got to be the one. And that, as I said, was a political case, which takes us back to the one even before that, to the larger picture, which is that, you know, the Clinton administration and other administrations before have said, oh, you want to talk to members of our administration? That's fine. You know, we will allow that. From the Congressional Research Service. The Congressional Research Service is an investigative arm of Congress that works for the members of Congress, is totally unpartisan. It's just a bunch of professional, you know, researchers, librarians, essentially, and researchers, many of them are lawyers, who work for Congress. And Congress can say, you know, how many grasshoppers are there in Kansas? You know, they go out and find out. So, or they would, you know, arguably they would find out, you know, well, testimony before Congress said. So anyhow, here's what the Congressional Research Service report said about whether a purge of attorneys is normal and ordinary. This being the issue that's being looked into here. They said of the 468 confirmations made by the Senate over a 25-year period, only 10 left office involuntarily. Now, this is, you know, other than the ones that Bush bounced. In virtually all of those 10 previous cases, serious issues of professional misconduct appeared to be the driving issue. Prior to December, for example, only two U.S. attorneys were fired outright for improper, and in one case, criminal behavior. The CRS report identifies six other U.S. attorneys who resigned during the 25-year period who were implicated in news reports of questionable conduct. For two others, they were unable to determine the cause. And these are people who got in fist fights, one case where somebody bit somebody, and, you know, it's just bizarre behavior. That's it. That's been the only reason in the past that U.S. attorneys have been fired, other than the resetting that occurs with every administration. But again, I think that we have to, frankly, my opinion is that what Congress needs to be looking at is not why were these guys fired, but were these guys fired, was the firing of these guys the result of a criminal conspiracy? This needs to be like a RICO investigation. We are looking into a criminal conspiracy to increase the prosecution of Democrats and diminish the prosecution of Republicans like Jerry Lewis. And therefore, you know, this has nothing to do with the national security issues that the Supreme Court has already ruled on, where they say that you have to have a claim of military, diplomatic, or sensitive national security secrets before you can compel testimony. And we're looking into crimes here. And then that raises the question, okay, if Congress is looking into crimes, isn't that by definition, if it's crimes by the president or that the president may be implicated in, isn't that in some way by definition an impeachment hearing? 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour on listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners, listening for our local sponsors, listening to your local affiliate, your local radio station, and letting those local sponsors know that you're buying their products and that you're listening to the program, and our national sponsors as well, sacredgroundscoffee.com, for example, smalldog.com, Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, Purina One Natural Blends, 866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. There, you'll recall the Nixon, we were talking earlier about Richard Nixon, and Nixon's pushing back using executive privilege, and I think that that's the precedent, really, that we have to look at here. But, you know, keeping in mind, Nixon's major pushback, the one that actually ended up before the Supreme Court, had to do with a criminal case. And there are so many things just laying around on the ground here that the Congress could be picking up and saying, hey, wait a minute, what about this? For example, Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman published a piece in Common Dreams yesterday titled Blowback from Ohio's 2004 Stolen Election is Escalating. Ohio's newly elected Secretary of State, Jennifer Brunner, has requested the resignation of all four members of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections. Felony convictions have also resulted in 18-month prison sentences for two employees of the Cuyahoga Board of Elections as a result of what the county prosecutor in the case calls the rigging of the outcome of the in the recount following the 2004 presidential election. You get this? This is, you know, Ohio. This is the state that gave Bush the presidency. This is the state. And now you've got actually several people have been sent to prison. Now, they're out on bail on appeal here, but they have been convicted and sentenced to 18 months in prison. The Secretary of State is now asking the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections chairman, Robert Bennett, to resign. He also, by the way, is the chairman of the Ohio Republican Party. He says he's going to refuse to resign. He says that the problems with the 2006 primary, he places the problems of private voting machine vendors, including Diebold. And he says that the rigging of the 2004 presidential recount was caused by the Cuyahoga County Prosecutor's Office, according to the Columbus Dispatch. This is from Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman's piece. They point out in the 2004 presidential election, Cuyahoga County suffered serious election irregularities that worked to the disadvantage of Democratic presidential candidate John Kerry. Among them, the purging of 24.9% of all the voters in the city of Cleveland. This is a city that went 83% for Kerry. But a quarter of their votes, of their voters, were purged. Mysterious and suspect vote totals for third-party candidates in majority African-American wards. Unexplained security problems, in quotes, that caused the last-minute shift of voting locations in the inner-city Cleveland public school polling places. And improbably low apparent turnouts in heavily Democratic inner-city wards. What's happening right now is since the Democrats took control of Ohio, the rigged election of 2004 is starting to come unraveled. People are actually going to jail over it, and it's getting no coverage whatsoever in the corporate media. This comes a week after Brunner's request for the resignations comes a week after two Cuyahoga County election workers were each sentenced to 18 months in prison for rigging the recount of the 2004 election in Ohio's biggest county. Jacqueline Maiden and Kathleen Dreamer were each convicted of a felony count of negligent misconduct by an election board employee. And then they go on to say, the Free Press has unearthed evidence including possible criminal conduct, misconduct by a wide range of election officials throughout the state, including Kenneth Blackwell. For example, right after the election, Cuyahoga County showed 562,498 votes were cast. 562,000. With 30,000 roughly as listed as absentee or provisional. 562,000, but the official result shows only 468,000. That means almost 100,000 ballots just vanished. 16.8% of all the votes cast in that county, a county that went 80% for Kerry. And keep in mind, you know, if just 50, 60,000 votes had been flipped from Bush to Kerry, or then John Kerry would be president right now. I mean, this is just one example of many things. I mean, you've got the purging of the prosecutors, the federal prosecutors. You've got the breaking of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. You've got lying us into a war in Iraq with the presidential State of the Union address when arguably a president is under oath. It's the only constitutionally mandated speech that the president has to give. And you add all this up, and it starts to look a lot like high crimes and misdemeanors, at least in my mind. Jerry in Long Island, New York. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I agree with your whole take on this. In fact, I think Bush's own possibly impeachable role in the U.S. attorney firings, I think that needs to be more greatly explored and scrutinized by Congress. And I think Bush himself needs to be subpoenaed and questioned under oath and under penalty of perjury about this matter. I mean, not only is it very serious, it very closely parallels in my mind one of the, a couple of things that another president, Andrew Johnson, was impeached for, especially to the extent that Bush has or will replace any of these fired U.S. attorneys without Senate confirmation. In fact, it's my understanding that's already been done in Arkansas. There was a Republican attorney who had advised Karl Rove, and he replaced less politically partisan.
And he's there. He's there right now, and he's the guy that they say, you know, the strategy is to gum it to death. You know, there was talk this thing to death, and sure enough, that's what's going on. Republican members of Congress right now are going, oh, yeah, we can look into this over sometime over the next 6-8 months, maybe a year, year and a half. And in the meantime, Karl Rove's guy is down there in Arkansas doing his thing. And then of course, you've got, you know, the people who were brought in. The one that concerns me is Jeff Taylor. This is the new guy. And this wasn't, by the way, one of the ones who were fired. This was a prosecutor, the federal prosecutor in the Washington, D.C. area, the guy who you know, any argument with Congress is going to go before or would have, you know, arguably the responsibility for prosecuting. He got promoted up in September. On September 22nd of last year, he got promoted up and out of his job and was replaced by a 42-year-old former aide to Orrin Hatch, a guy who had worked as a lawyer to Gonzalez. He was a counselor to Gonzalez. In other words, he was offering advice to Gonzalez, legal advice. And before that, what did he do for Orrin Hatch? He helped write the Patriot Act. And this is the guy, you know, it just gets very, very strange. It gets very strange. Bob in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Bob, what's on your mind today? Hey, Bob.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about all the current things that you're talking about in government. Are you there?
I am.
Okay. And first of all, I appreciate your intelligent investigation into the different areas, and you're explaining those things in a very logical way. You're have very good insight. But my concern is, and I think many Americans have the same concern, is it looks to me like we're regressing back to the kind of like the Dark Ages, where we have an aristocracy running the country.
Yes.
And all of the decisions that are being made are based on money, either corporate or otherwise. And it seems to me that Americans need to look at taking back the country.
I agree with you, Bob. This takes us back to the original liberal versus conservative argument. Alexander Hamilton argued that there should be an aristocracy based on wealth. that in fact, it was his opening speech before the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and he was basically booed down. In fact, he was so humiliated by the response that he didn't show up for about two-thirds of the Constitutional Convention, although to his credit, he was the only member of the New York delegation who did come back and actually vote for the Constitution, which is a good thing, and then he helped sell it along with Madison and the Federalist Papers. But Hamilton made this opening speech in which he said that the president should be elected for life, that the British form of government, essentially a monarchy with a semi, one semi-elected branch of Congress and one, more or less elected branch of Congress, directly elected branch of Congress, was the best that had ever been created, and that we should do everything we could to emulate it. And the only thing wrong with it was that the lineage of kings was genetic rather than based on merit. And, how do you define merit? Well, the Calvinists of the day were very clear about it, that, wealth is a sign of the blessing of God. So I'd say you're absolutely right. These guys want to reinvent an aristocracy and one that's based on wealth. Absolutely. Chris in Santa Fe. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom. Well, when Bush threw down the gauntlet yesterday, he referenced three times the latest document dump that came up day before yesterday and characterized it as unusually open and unprecedented in its
There is a Rosemary Woods moment in this thing. There's
definitely
a gap from
yes.
mid-November to early December.
To
in
December
all of these,
4th, the gap.
Right.
No emails, no communications between the White House and the DOJ. My question is...
Rosemary Woods was working in the White House.
My question is, can George W. Bush actually afford to have Karl Rove testify anywhere under oath? Because it's kind of like having Hannibal Lecter, cater your birthday party. everything will come out.
Yeah, I think that that's an imperfect analogy, but I get the point. No, obviously, he can't allow Rove to testify. If Rove testifies under oath and he gets a serious grilling and has to answer, honestly, questions about a whole variety of things, from outing CIA agents to purging attorneys, Bush is toast. It's the end of his presidency. 45 minutes past the hour.
In broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. The Washington Post reporting that they're going through the document dump, this huge document dump, which has this Rosemary Woods gap in it from mid-November to early December. But nonetheless, what they're finding is they say the documents also show that the White House was more closely involved than had been known in attempting to contain the controversy as it began to spin out of control in recent weeks, this being Attorney Gate or Prosecutor Gate or whatever you want to call it. So, interesting. Ellen Ratner's on the line of the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, good day, and today was Al Gore's testimony, which seemed to a lot of observers to be back in high school. The entire testimony on the House side got held up because Joe Barton was disagreeing with Chairman Dingell or with Mr. Dingell about where certain members of Congress should sit. This went on for about 10 minutes. Then Mr. Barton, who's the ranking member, started to complain that former Vice President Gore sent his testimony at 1 a.m., which is a violation since the rules clearly state it has to be in 48 hours beforehand. And Dingell just humored Barton. He kept saying with a smile on his face that Barton was being recognized by the chairman and explained to him that exceptions can be made at the discretion of the chair. And, I mean, this just went on and on and on. And then he told Mr. Barton that he might be interested in reading An Inconvenient Truth to prepare his questions. And asked if Joe Barton did not have a copy of this, he'd be more than happy to provide him with it.
That's great. That's
It's unbelievable that these people are elected.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you mean like Joe Barton, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, he is serving a certain constituency of people who aren't paying too much attention to politics on the one hand and K Street lobbyists on the other. So, you know, it's called the Republican Party. And frankly, you know, to be honest, a few members of the Democratic Party as well. Ellen, I'm curious what the subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee has voted to authorize the Judiciary Committee to issue subpoenas in the Lawyergate case. Does this have an official name yet that's being broadly used in Washington, D.C.?
I don't think it has an official name yet, but I could be wrong.
That's how you know that this is one of those cases that the Republican spinmeisters are not working on, because they used to come up with, you know, attorney gate, file gate, you know, the travel gate. I mean, they were so, you know, within minutes. You know, they were, Frank Luntz was, you know, running these things past focus groups, and they had them out there. So in any case, this scandal that may be, I mean, you know, it's this has never happened before.
Yes, we don't have a gate at the end of it. But we do have 8 subpoenas that were issued today. And it's interesting, Linda Sanchez, who was subcommittee chair, said, the question they have to ask themselves in, are you more interested in a political spectacle than getting the truth? And then she said there really does have to be accountability.
Right. Now, my understanding is that the actual, you know, to put a fine point on it, is that what Linda Sanchez's subcommittee did was they authorized John Conyers' committee to issue the subpoenas, but they didn't actually issue the subpoenas. They simply authorized the subpoenas. And now Conyers has to put his stamp on them. He has to sign off on them and actually authorize the subpoena.
Right. It was the subcommittee, and they approved it by voice vote. But right. I think it's just a question, obviously, of time.
Yeah. So it just happens tomorrow. Now, if these subpoenas, when these subpoenas are issued, and when the White House says, no, we're not going to show up for no stinking congressional hearings, does this not then go to a federal prosecutor? Well, then it goes back to Congress to decide whether to charge the president with, or the president's office, these people who didn't show up, with contempt of Congress.
Right.
And that's a simple majority vote in both the House and the Senate. If they succeed, then it has to go to a federal prosecutor, doesn't it, to be prosecuted?
It does,
in court,
by the District Court of, in the District of Columbia.
Right, so the federal prosecutor would have to either impanel a grand jury or go before the court. And that guy is Jeff Taylor. He was he sworn into office on September 29th by Alberto Gonzalez just 6 months ago. He is 42 years old. He used to be Alberto Gonzalez's lawyer. And before that, he worked for Orrin Hatch. He helped write the Patriot Act.
And there is definitely that Republican Bush connection there, and the question is whether he will do what he wants to do politically, or whether he will do what he should do constitutionally.
Yeah, interesting. Is anybody talking about a special prosecutor at this point?
I have heard nothing of. I think they're going to let this run its course. I think that they are going to see what happens with the subpoenas, whether the White House caves, whether there's more document dumps, whether the 18-minute gap in the tape is dealt with, and I think they're going to see what comes out. I think they're taking this in a very step-by-step fashion.
Yeah, which is probably the wisest thing to do. It doesn't give instant gratification to those of us who would like it to have happened 4 years ago, but nonetheless, and what about looking into things like the rigged election in Ohio? We have now 2 election officials who have actually been sentenced to prison as a result of rigging the election in Ohio.
And the entire Cuyahoga County Board of Elections by the Secretary of State was asked to get out of there.
I
am born and bred in Cuyahoga County.
So you know the story.
Yes,
and you've got that, and you've got, you know, Bush listening, you know, wiretapping us illegally, violating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Are some of these other crimes going to be looked into, and could this create a critical mass for impeachment?
Well, you know, Nancy Pelosi has said time and time again that impeachment is off the table, and I always said it really depends on what they begin to get when they do these investigations. Right. They may be forced into it. But yeah. One never knows. And, of course, Tony Snow this morning was doing his, you know, White House dance on this. And as we go on, there's a briefing, and I'm sure he's going to continue to do more dancing.
Yeah, although back in 98, he was saying that basically claiming executive privilege would give a president the right to, would have a constitutional right to cover up.
So and he's calling it a media spectacle.
Yeah, indeed. Ellen Ratner at Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. You know, sometimes you know what you know. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. Sometimes you know what you don't know. Sometimes you don't know what you do know that you don't know. And sometimes even everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong. But you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Could it be our Everything You Know Is Wrong segment, by the way, sponsored by TheLiberalStore.com. All things liberal and bumper stickers, buttons, T-shirts, and more. Check out the liberal teddy bear there now at the, T-H-E, LiberalStore.com. Our Everything You Know Is Wrong guest today, Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy Scahill is on the line. He's the author, investigative reporter. New book, Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. I should, in fact, say the Polk Award-winning investigative reporter, investigative journalist, a frequent reporter for The Nation and Democracy Now! And other venues. Jeremy Scahill, welcome.
It's great to be with you, Tom.
Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. What, The presentation of the book and the information, and I mean, it raises a whole lot of, I mean, there's a whole series of issues and questions that we should discuss, having to do with, you know, who are these people, how do they get this kind of power, where, you know, what is their agenda and all that, but let's take the biggest frame first. What's wrong with a private mercenary army?
Well, the very essence of a mercenary is a soldier whose primary motive is monetary gain. Now, Blackwater has taken the traditional mercenary values and sort of swirled them together with a sort of neo-patriotic dedication to defending the so-called war on terror. And Blackwater would say that its forces only engage in defensive operations, which is a statement that absolutely falls apart when you realize that this is a company that has served as the Praetorian Guard for the Bush administration's global war on terror. They guard the scene. Senior U.S. diplomats in Iraq, several regional occupation offices in the country. They really have become like a sort of elite private guard for the Bush administration, and they're engaged in an absolutely offensive campaign in Iraq, which is the occupation of that country. Now, the administration has totally failed to build a coalition of willing nations, so instead they've built what some call a coalition of the billing, and a large portion of these are mercenaries who are profiting from the war. Further, Blackwater itself has hired scores of mercenaries from other countries, including Colombia, Chile, Bulgaria, etc. Some of these countries oppose the Iraq war, and yet Blackwater has gone in and through the back door internationalized the occupation forces by hiring mercenaries from countries that in some cases oppose the war itself.
In the Revolutionary War, George Washington hired mercenaries.
Yeah, Blackwater loves to pull that one out.
Yeah, I mean,
we're serving in the great tradition of, you know, George Washington's forces.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
Although
they're serving offensive wars.
Right. I don't recall our hiring mercenaries during the Second World War, during the First World War, during the Korean War. I mean, we have a long tradition in this country of our military being loyal first and foremost to the United States of America, as opposed to the dollar. And your point, Jeremy Scahill, sounds like you said that the if I understood correctly, that in your opinion the arguably moral wrong of a mercenary army is that their first loyalty is to the dollar and not to the nation. Is that a good summary?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of the, when I use the term mercenary, I actually feel it's most appropriate for the men who run these companies, the men who run Blackwater. They're the true mercenaries. The guys that they hire, I think, are a mixture of different kinds of people. On the one hand, I think you have guys who want to continue their service in the military, and don't want to just be paid $28,000 a year, and so they sign up with a private company and believe that what they're doing is extending their service through other means. You also have other guys who are just straight up mercenaries who say, I want $1,000 a day, tax free, I'll go over to Iraq and kill some Hajis. Right. And that's where I think the real problem lies.
No, but my point is if there is a moral wrong in having mercenary armies, and I think we're in agreement on that, I'm curious, at what point did America as a country either change a soft policy, that is, we simply, in the past, always thought it was morally wrong. Like, we always thought it was morally wrong for CEOs to make more than 40 or 50 times what their employees made.
Right.
That never happened in America, other than about a 40-year period during the robber Aaron Burr in the late 1900s, until after Reagan. You know, there was a moral shift as a consequence of people at the top. Was it a moral change, or was it actually a legal change? Was there a change in law that allowed the use of mercenary armies that opened the way for Blackwater, or was it simply this change in perspective at the top of the Bush administration?
Well, Tom, I'm glad you asked that question. It's actually a very important question that seldom gets asked. And the fact of the matter is that when President Eisenhower left office in the early 1960s, he warned of the dangers of an unchecked rise of the military-industrial complex. And from the end of World War II to the present, we've sort of seen an escalation in privatization of war making. But traditionally, it's been through technology, weapons manufacturers, military consultancy firms, etc. The Bush administration took power with the most radical privatization agenda in U.S. history, and the Rumsfeld Doctrine was the use of small footprint forces, special forces, high-end technology, and a widespread and increased use of private contractors. This was the life's work of Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld. When Cheney was defense secretary under George H.W. Bush, he commissioned a study from a division of Halliburton, the company he would go on to head, to look at how to greater privatize the military bureaucracy. And so through the 1990s, the Clinton administration was on board with the privatization, and they hired Halliburton to deploy in the Balkans and elsewhere. But when Bush took office in 2000, 2001, the radical component of this kicked in, to the point where we now have about 100,000 contractors in Iraq alone, 48,000 private contractors working for mercenary companies in Iraq. This is a radical revolution in military affairs that we have seen carried out by this administration.
Which also means that the actual American presence in Iraq is 250,000 people, not the 130,000 that we keep hearing.
Absolutely. And that, again, that's a very important point. The fact is that almost 800 contractors have been documented to have been killed in Iraq. Their numbers aren't counted in the official toll. 7,600 of them have been injured in Iraq, and those aren't counted either. But more important than their deaths is their crimes. They go undocumented, unreported, unresearched, unprosecuted, and unpunished. There has been one, Tom, one private contractor indicted for crimes in Iraq, and he wasn't even one of these armed mercenaries. He was alleged to have stabbed someone in a kitchen somewhere. So the fact of the matter is that the Bush administration has created a total Wild West atmosphere in Iraq for these mercenary companies, and it's sort of a payback for the political expediency they offer the administration.
Which brings me to one of the issues that you bring up later in your book. You've got chapters about Mr. Prince and about the Christian right and their affiliation with this administration, and how there's a juxtaposition between ideology, religion, and profit in this essentially war-making business.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most frightening stories that I came across. Eric Prince, the mega millionaire who founded and runs Blackwater, comes from a right-wing Christian dynasty in the state of Michigan. His family created an empire servicing the auto industry in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and they invented the now ubiquitous lighted sun visor, and when you flip down the visor in your car, that's the Prince family that invented that. But more important, his father was very close to Dick DeVos, the man man who ran Amway. And the two of these
Amway ran for governor in Michigan, by the way, in the last election and lost.
Right. So he's married, though. The guy who lost in Michigan in the gubernatorial race ran as a Republican. He's married to Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater's sister. And so these two families, the Amway family, the Amway Corporation and the Prince Corporation, sort of merged, literally, their families merged, and they became some of the premier bankrollers of the Republican Revolution of 1994 that brought Newt Gingrich to power. They gave the seed money to Gary Bauer to start the Family Research Council. They heavily funded James Dobson and his focus on the family, their network of prayer warriors. And Eric Prince was an intern in the George H.W. Bush White House, but he complained that it wasn't conservative enough for him on gay issues, the balanced budget, and the environment. Prince himself was one of the wealthiest people ever to join the U.S. Navy SEALs. Some say he's the wealthiest. But when his father died in 95, they sold the business for a little less than $1.5 billion in cash. Eric Prince's wife had cancer, so being in the SEALs was no longer an option, so he started Blackwater, incorporated it in 1996, started building it up in 97 on 5,000 acres in North Carolina, and it now has turned into the Praetorian Guard for the War on Terror.
So, and the Christian component to it, I mean, how does that, his personal, very conservative variety of Christianity, how does that influence the actual activities of Blackwater, and does that influence the type of people they hire, the type of work they do? You would think that somebody who calls themselves a Christian would be interested in perhaps peacemaking rather than war making.
Right. Bible in one hand.
Jesus is referred to as the Prince of Peace, you know.
Right. Christian soldiers, Bible in one hand, gun in the other.
That's another dimension of, you know, the history.
Right. I mean, Eric Prince, interestingly, his family, they were very strict Calvinists, but he himself is a convert to Catholicism, and he's gotten wrapped up with a whole variety of unsavory characters, one of them being Chuck Colson, who was Nixon's hatchet man, President Nixon's hatchet man, one of the first people to go to jail for Watergate. And he, Chuck Colson, has now remade himself as one of the most prominent evangelical figures in the country, very close to President Bush. And Eric Prince has been a major funder of Chuck Colson's faith-based prisons in the United States. Chuck Colson's organization runs one Christian prison in Sugar Land, Texas, the former district of House Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Right. And Eric Prince is also involved with, you know, sort of missionary organizations like Christian Freedom International, on whose board he serves. They believe that the only word, infallible word of God is the Bible, and they have missionary operations in various countries. Prince has also hired several, you know, dedicated right-wing Christian activists as executives in his company. One of them is Joseph Schmitz, who was the former Pentagon Inspector General. He was charged with policing the big war contractor Bonanza when the invasion of Iraq began, and ended up resigning under fire from both Democrats and Republicans, saying that he had failed to do his job. And this was a guy who absolutely adored Donald Rumsfeld, whose operation he was supposed to be overseeing. He would carry around Rumsfeld's principles in his breast pocket and would give speeches about what a great wrestler Donald Rumsfeld had been earlier in life. But the scariest thing about Joseph Schmitz, who is now a senior executive at Blackwater, is that he boasts of his membership in the military order, in the Order of Malta, which is a Christian militia dating back to the First Crusade. So to have these kinds of forces,
a Catholic Christian. Is exactly. Eric Prince an Opus Dei as well?
I'm not. I have nothing that would indicate that. I mean, it's the politics.
I mean, we've got a couple of Supreme Court justices who apparently are.
Right. I mean, this is you could write a whole book about the Christian connections of this company, and I tried to do as comprehensive as a job I could without getting readers into too much muck.
Yeah, yeah. I you know, speaking as a Christian, I find it tragic. I think the militarization of Christianity is something that we saw in the 12th century, and I think most Christians hope to never see again. But in any case, it's an extraordinary piece of work that you've done here, Jeremy Scahill. Blackwater, the rise of the world's most powerful mercenary army. And just to wrap this up, we are, you know, flat out of time, but just to wrap this up, where do we go from here? I mean, is this the sort of thing that will ever be subject to congressional oversight? Is it the sort of thing that might ever be made illegal? Or is Blackwater, I mean, you know, they were in New Orleans, for God's sake.
Yeah, they were in New Orleans making $240,000 a day, billing the federal government $950 per day per man deployed in the hurricane zone. Congress is starting to look at this. Henry Waxman is emerging as a sort of pit bull on Blackwater in particular. He held his first round of hearings in early February. The problem, though, Tom, is that even the Democrats don't want to be portrayed as anti-contractor because these are big campaign contributions. And so much of the focus is on oversight and transparency. The only congressperson I know that views this through the lens of privatization of war is Congressman Dennis Kucinich. And I think that we're quite a ways away from Congress getting on the same page as Representative Kucinich. Yeah. But what people can do is when they call their representatives and say, I want U.S. forces out of Iraq, make sure to say, I want the contractors out too, because that effectively, as you point out, doubles the occupation force.
Yeah, yeah. Although, interestingly, you know, Kucinich is also a conservative Catholic in many regards, so...
He is, and I think that a lot of people in Congress are getting their first window into how frightening Blackwater is, and you know, the Christian aspect of it is a very important part of it, but the much bigger picture is this is the privatization of war, and it takes all of us further away from accountability and oversight and shining a light on the operations. We have enough trouble keeping track of what official U.S. forces are doing. Now you've got 100,000 shadow force army operating in Iraq.
Yeah. Amazing. Jeremy Scahill, the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, as they say, available in fine bookstores everywhere now. Jeremy, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Tom, and thanks for everything you do.
It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be back right after this. Larry Scott from VAWatchdog.org to find out what's going on with the Veterans Administration. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
And welcome back. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Larry Scott on the line with us. He's the chief cook and bottle washer over at VAWatchdog.org, one of the best veterans sites on the Internet. Hey, Larry.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you again.
Great to have you with us. Is this the Veterans Administration saying that maybe you don't need to work through post-traumatic stress disorder? You just need to get over it?
No. This is a group of researchers, and the study that just came out today, as a matter of fact, a group of researchers have decided that the PTSD diagnosis is inflated, greatly overinflated, and they need tighter definitions on PTSD. And this stems from some pretty in-depth research, and it's something that has been kind of bandied about inside the mental health community for some time. You remember that post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, was codified back in 1980, and then the diagnosis...
So do you think this is a good thing, Larry, or a bad thing?
I think this is a good thing.
We just have a few seconds left, so I want to get all this stuff in here. Senator correcting the DAV's anti-attorney statement, the DAV?
Well, the Disabled American Veterans is opposing legislation that will go into effect in June, allowing veterans to hire attorneys, if they want, to represent them in the VA claims process. We have Senator Larry Craig of Idaho, who the DAV misquoted, and Craig thinks he was misrepresented in this whole thing. And he's taking them to task and saying, let's be honest about it. Let's be legal about it. Let's give veterans a choice of using an attorney if they want to, which I think they should have that opportunity, Tom.
Yeah, I agree with you. Larry Scott, the founder and editor of VAWatchdog.org. Check it out, VAWatchdog.org. Larry, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
And welcome back. It's the place where our talking points come from, Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. There is an all-out war that has been declared on men by conservatives. It is taking the guise of an all-out war on women. Now, you know, I realize this sounds absolutely counterintuitive. But just, you know, just consider, for example, here, this, you know, Limbaugh recently talking about Hillary Clinton.
A lot of Democrats worried that, you know, she doesn't have she doesn't connect on TV. We talked about this. She doesn't come across as friendly. She does, you know, she's my favorite name for her is Nurse Ratched.
Yeah, and in fact, well, actually, you know, I'm going to pause this for just a second because we just got a shout out from Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Ellen, you have a tip for us.
Well, it's very interesting. Today at the briefing, Tony Snow said that he was not really aware that the president had been briefed about what had happened with Gonzalez and the U.S. attorney issue, and that he also said the president did not sign off on the filings. In other words, it was done below the presidential level. Well, then CNN, Ed Henry, who I have to say has been on a complete roll lately, said, well, if no conversations occurred with the president and no advice was given, then how can the White House assert executive privilege? Because, of course, the president said yesterday, people need to be able to come into the Oval Office and tell them what they think. And Tony said, that's an intriguing question.
And that's it?
That's it.
But that's amazing.
Essentially, there you have it. How can they assert executive privilege?
Tony Snow just blew up his own boss's argument. And this also suggests that yesterday or day before yesterday, George Bush was either lying to us or lying to us about how, these were private confidential conversations.
Well, they may be private confidential conversations. They may have occurred in the White House, but apparently they did not occur between the president and the parties at hand.
Yeah, interesting. Very interesting. Ellen, thanks for the heads up on that.
A quick one, but I couldn't resist calling you with it.
No, I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
It's You're welcome.
Great to hear from you. Ellen Ratner, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Let me get back to this war on this. You were hearing Mr. Limbaugh here, and he's getting into this whole thing about Hillary.
I mean, we created this whole concept of the testicle lockbox in connection with Mrs. Clinton. I mean, she has that kind of appeal to people. She's you fill in the blanks here.
Now, you would think this sounds like, you know, an attack on Hillary, and it is. It very much is. But it's not limited to Limbaugh. Here's Tucker Carlson, for example, talking about Hillary Clinton.
It's not like Hillary's some communist or something. You know what I mean? She's no more liberal than Barack Obama. She's more conservative, probably, in some ways. There's just something about her that feels castrating, overbearing, and scary.
Castrating. Interesting. And then here we have Michael Savage going off on Barbara Walters. Barbara Walters, first of all, interviewing Hugo Chavez. And then this, what can only be described in my mind, is a paranoid rant by Michael Savage.
You are a very dignified man. But we have heard you called the President of the United States a devil, a donkey, a drunk, a liar, a coward, a murderer. What does all this name-calling accomplish?
You notice what she just did? She used this dictator in Venezuela as a forum, as a fulcrum, in order to call the president those names.
Yeah, so Michael Savage asserting that Barbara Walters needs to use Chavez to call. And then he continues with his opinion of this woman.
Notice what this double-talking slut just did, this mind slut, Barbara Walters.
This is conservative talk radio you're listening to here.
And I stick by those words. She's an empty mind slut. She'd peddle anything for a ratings point. That mental prostitute, Barbara Walters, it sickens me. I think that the woman is vermin. I think she's dirt.
So this is Michael Savage. And again, I'm telling you, this is actually as much a war on women as it is on men. Let's say it's both. But you had Tucker Carlson, Limbaugh, actually, when he referred to the testicle lockbox, this is the ad that came out in December of 2003 that, you know, they created, for his, over at, whatever, EIB or whatever.
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes that you need? The Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox. You can finally grab the power that's keeping Hillary Clinton safe from tough media questions. The Hillary Rodham Clinton testicle lockbox is...
And, you know, and on it goes. I mean, it goes on for a little over a minute. And then, you know, again, back to Michael Savage talking about another woman. Here's Michael Savage on Diane Sawyer.
Why you they think they're doing
whore.
What they're doing. Even
you lying whore.
Teach you something about why they are doing what
you
they're doing.
You lying whore.
Trying to bring back.
So that's Michael Savage talking over Diane Sawyer.
Real information in this critical time for these people who live in that part of the world. It is so complicated.
You're full of crap. Who do you think you're fooling? You're a liar, and the reason you gave this interview about that interview is because you realize what you have done. You're being told that the people hate your guts. I don't know how this goes on in this country.
And continues, okay? So, you know, calling Diane Sawyer a whore and on and on and on. And here's how it works. And it's really a pretty straightforward process. Most men, if you ask them, who are you? Or what do? You won't hear them say something like, I'm my wife's husband or I'm my son's dad. Instead, typically, men usually describe themselves by what they do for a living. Which is one of the reasons why in this day and age, so many men are really troubled. Because what we do for a living, what men do for a living, is no longer safe and secure. Ever since Ronald Reagan declared war on working people in 1981... When at that point, we had 25% of the American workforce unionized, 50% of Americans had the kind of job where one person could raise a family and have a retirement and put their kids through school and have full health benefits and the whole bit. Now we're down to, what, 7, 8% of the private workforce? So today's poor and middle-class men living with job insecurity, declining standard of living, they feel emasculated. Their ability to earn a living is eroded, and with it, their own sense of their own adequacy, their potency, their ability to project themselves in the world and conquer it in the way that meets the needs of their family. And the result is getting conspicuous. For example, the BBC. They reported in July of 2003, suicide is the single biggest cause of accidental or violent death among men in England and Wales, even exceeding car deaths. They noted that this accounted for more than one-third, 34% of the total number of male accidental or violent deaths during the year. It's a particular problem, they noted, for men in areas of high unemployment, such as Britain's suicide capital, Manchester. In that community, suicide rate among working-age men has doubled over the last 20 years, essentially since Maggie Thatcher. The problem has spread, that would be actually, what, 30 years now? 25 years, yeah. The problem has spread throughout the developed world where good jobs are being lost in droves. In Japan, for example, Japan Update News Service reports that in the working-class prefecture of Okinawa, quote, the male suicide rate per 100,000 people has increased 1.5 times compared to 20 years ago. Again, as the government becomes more conservative, as jobs become more in the hands of multinational corporations and not in the hands of working people, they add the suicide rate in the 50 to 60 age group is especially high, and the reason for the dramatic increase is thought to be a combination of low income and high unemployment. Bingo. The majority of employed or underemployed men, and I would say women as well, don't kill themselves. However, instead, they get angry and look for sources of their anger. And this is where the conservatives are working hard to do a very elegant smoke and mirrors switch of attention. Conservatives have figured out how crucial it is to get the NASCAR dad. And yet, the success of the whole conservative program of strangling government, drowning government in the bathtub, of doing away with those regulations that would control multinational corporations, might diminish the paychecks of the CEOs of giant corporations, depends on essentially screwing the NASCAR dad. So, no pun intended. Thus, the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox and the phallic projection force war in Iraq and the big bulge strut on the Air Force carrier deck. This is all psychological warfare. Now, this is just very straightforward. Arlie Hochschild, in a brilliant essay back about 3 years ago called Let Them Eat War, noted that George W. Bush and Karl Rove have effectively used 9/11 as a substitute for job anxiety. And Bush's war on Iraq, and now his occupation, we'll say, but nonetheless the initial war, is a symbolic way for men to vicariously feel personal power via their stand-in, the macho acting guy in the White House, right? And so you have all these conservative talkers out there trashing women or blaming women. It's not, I would submit to you that this isn't even, you know, Michael Savage and Tucker Carlson and Rush Limbaugh trashing women. It's blaming them so that the men who are finding themselves unemployed, out of work, underemployed, scared to death about their future, and feeling like they can't provide for their families, they will turn their anger not on the conservatives who have created that world, but instead on women, and specifically on Hillary Clinton. It's a very slick psychological trick, and these guys are very slick at that kind of thing. I just wanted to point it out to you. We'll take a few calls when we come back. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile. But more than anything, more than anything, my wish for you
is for democracy. It's for all the very best. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Little Beirut, as George Bush Sr. refers to Portland, Oregon, where we're broadcasting from 620 KPOJ, our home studio. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number here on Air America Radio. And Wade in Colorado, welcome to the program. Wade, what's up?
Hey, man, I just wanted to comment on the Blackwater speaker that you had before.
Sure. Jeremy Scahill.
Yeah. I live in Colorado now. I'm out here on the Western Slope. My day job is, you know, working with senior citizens. My volunteer job is doing all I can to get John Edwards in office. But coming
from,
I'm originally from North Carolina. I've got an in-law who's in Blackwater, and I've been home and met some Blackwater folks. You know, one of the guys, the first thing I want to say is those mercenaries that are working for Blackwater, most of them are real patriots, are good guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I met one guy down at the beach in North Carolina last year. He was about 6'6", big guy, hulking dude. And he said that he took the job for the money, and he felt like he had basically sold his soul. And he was near the point of tears when he was describing some, he wouldn't go into detail, but he was talking about the missions they went on, that the innocent people they had killed. And, you know, I felt so bad for him. But I knew that he had signed up with good intentions. And that's the one thing I wanted to comment on. And
well,
the other thing is the end game. And I want, mm-hmm. you know, I know conspiracy theories aren't, you know, real popular, but I've just been thinking. I was listening to Randy Rose the other day, and she had on Scott Ritter, who was talking about what would happen if we invaded Iran or attacked Iran, and the price of oil, how it would go up, and the effect on cost of food, and you know. And then he talked about the Martial Law Act that Bush recently got passed,
And,
yeah, no, actually, that goes all the way back to Nixon, the original one. But no, I get your point, Wade, and I've got to move along. I've got a bunch of other callers here, but a good point. And should we be really concerned that Blackwater, or not necessarily even Blackwater? I mean, this isn't really, in my mind, about any particular one company. It's about the rules of the game. I mean, you know, is the idea of creating private armies, armed armies, something that really should be legal in the United States? Sheila in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Sheila.
Hi there. Well, gee, you keep moving on, and I have lots of things to say. I think this Blackwater thing has even greater significance, and this is going to conspiracy theory again, but just think if they had a couple million people in this country who were actually members of Blackwater or employees, but we didn't know it, and, remember Kent State. Things like that can happen, that this could be like Bush's SS.
Yeah, things can get out of control. Well, you go back and you look at the history of the brown shirts, and, you know, it was basically Hitler's private army. It was official.
Yeah.
Yeah, the brown shirts, the original brown shirts were privatized, essentially. Actually, most of them were volunteers, but at least early on. But interesting point, Sheila. Greg in San Diego. Hey, Greg.
Hi. I was really intrigued by the whole Blackwater discussion. And, you know, in the San Diego area, Blackwater just recently got approval to build an 800-acre training facility out right near the Mexican border, out east of San Diego. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I were in business, I think I would find a place other than Southern California just to go shoot targets with paintballs if I'm trying to save money. And to me, the whole thing smacks of, you know, maybe it's conspiratorial, but I can see that one of these days, maybe Blackwater has intentions to patrol the border for us too. Maybe
and if the Bush administration, the Bush administration's privatizing everything, and if they privatize border patrol, then and Blackwater's doing a good job of it, what's wrong with that? The question isn't, you know, should Blackwater exist or not, or is Blackwater doing something wrong? Because frankly, they do exist, they have a right to exist, and as far as I can tell, they're not doing anything wrong, illegally wrong. The question is, do we want to continue down this road of privatizing our military? Do we want to continue down the road of privatizing police functions in the United States? That's where I think that, frankly, conservatives and liberals together should have a concern.
Yeah, myself.
And it's got nothing to do with Blackwater per se. It has to do with the whole idea of, you know, handing government functions over to private companies that are not accountable to we the people. And you know, I have some concerns about that. David, thanks for the call. David in San Francisco. Hey, David, we've got about a minute left. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. For that first caller who called from Colorado, they had privatized many of the prisons out there, and the politicians were essentially sending prisoners to prisons that they owned and then putting them in for extended terms. But I was actually calling about the privatization of mental institutions as well. By coincidence, I was reading a book about Alexander Cruden, Cruden, and apparently he wrote the Complete Concordance of the Bible. And he was essentially put into a privatized madhouse in the 1740s, and when he tried to get habeas corpus to let him out, the British courts said that a privatized mental institution, you're not entitled to habeas corpus. So
right, because it wasn't the government holding you.
Right, yeah. If he was in a public madhouse, he would be entitled to it, but under privatized, you're not. So privatizing justice is what this is all about.
Yeah, it's a spooky precedent. David, thank you. Wow. And on that note, coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Chris Winston on her new book about children, How to Raise an American. I think it should be titled, How to Brainwash a Child to Be a Republican. That and more, and your calls, the news of the day as well, right here on the Tom Hartman Program, the radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.